I'm going to talk this morning about an enlightenment poem that was written by a Japanese nun almost 800 years ago. Her name's Mugai Nyodai, and if you've been here on a Saturday morning for our service, you've probably heard her name chanted. She's one of the 54 women ancestors whose names that we chant during the Saturday service. The enlightenment poem, it's on the cover of the bulletin. It goes like this. With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail, no more moon in the water. A story has grown up around this poem that's based on Mugai Nyodai's life. And in the same way that movies do today, some of the elements of the story get shuffled around in order to serve the narrative. And so it veers away from the historical record a little bit. Well, a lot. But, you know, in the same, Dave and I went and saw Monuments Men a few weeks ago, and I really enjoyed it. And then I went home and Googled it and found, a whole different story that I really enjoyed. So I like these. So it's fine. And this is this is the movie or the teaching version of Mugai Nyodai's life. If any of you were Hollywood producers or anything, this would be a good one, I think. Chiono was a servant in a Zen nunnery, in a Zen monastery, in a convent. And her job was cutting firewood and carrying water from the stream back up to the convent. And she really wanted to practice Zazen. Often, young women would come visit the convent and they would stay for a while, groups of young women. And sometimes she'd peek in the window of the zendo and watch them practice, and she'd be so impressed. She said to herself, "Even girls too young to know the difference between right and wrong are in there doing this difficult practice with the nuns. They have a profound aspiration to awaken. How appropriate it is that they're called disciples of the Buddha. How can I, who lack such impressive qualities, ever be like them?" Oh. 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 So one day, she approached an elderly nun in the convent and said to her, "I'm of humble birth. I can't read or write, and I have to work all the time. Is there any possibility that I could attain the way of Buddha, even though I have no skills?" And the nun answered her by saying, "This is wonderful, my dear. We make no distinctions between people. There is only this. Each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion in order to free all beings. People are complete as they are. If you don't fall into delusive thoughts, there is no Buddha and no sentient being." Buddha, no sentient being over here. "There's only one complete nature. If you want to know your true nature," the nun said, "you need to turn toward the source of your delusive thoughts. And this is called Zazen." And Chiono was very happy with this answer. And she said, "With this practice as my companion, I only have to go about my daily life practicing day and night." So according to the legend, she then became a nun, and she received the Dharma name Mugai Nyodai, and meditated and practiced with the nuns there for many years. And then early one evening, she was carrying water up from the stream up to the convent. And she was carrying it in a rickety old bucket. that she had worked hard for a long time to hold together. She would take bamboo strips and wrap them around the bucket, trying to hold it together. So this one evening she was carrying water back up from the stream in her rickety old bucket, and as she was walking, she was gazing down at the water, and she could see the reflection of the moon in the water. And suddenly the bottom of the bucket fell out, and the water spilled everywhere, and it dissolved the moon's reflection, and in that moment she had a great awakening. So that's the story. And then she wrote her enlightenment poem, which is, it's a tradition a lot of time. You read enlightenment poems that old masters wrote about their enlightenment experience, and you also read death poems that people wrote the people wrote before they died. People sometimes write before they die. So her poem again is, "With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail, no more moon in the water." So Chiono, the servant, she's a servant, and she works really hard. She has kind of a tough life working there in the convent. And she doesn't really have any time for intensive Zen practice because they keep her running all the time. And the first hint in the story that you get that it might be a little bit of a fable is that her two jobs are chopping firewood and carrying water. It's an old Zen saying: before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. And so that means that after people have great awakenings, it's not like they go into the God realm, you know. They have their great awakenings, and then they stay right here. And their lives still have their ups and downs. They still have to take care of things. They still have to get water from the creek. The difference is in how they go about doing it. The difference is in their attitude and the spaciousness that they do, that they go through their daily lives with. So she's a servant. She's chopping wood. She's carrying water. We also find out that she's illiterate, she can't read or write, and she thinks that the young women who come visit have got something that she doesn't have, and she feels that they have a very strong aspiration to practice, and that they in some way are really different than she is. The thing about being illiterate is also something that you see a lot in the Zen stories. Wei Nung, the sixth patriarch, in the Platform Sutra, in the beginning of it, he's portrayed as being illiterate, and he may have been, but it's a way of saying that even this person with no book learning at all can awaken. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is in here. A modern day take on that might be that even someone very learned still might have the opportunity to awaken. You know, even your doctorate in comparative religions might not preclude you from being able to become awakened if you practice very hard. So then she has this wonderful encounter with the elderly grandmotherly nun. And, you know, in a lot of the Zen stories, there will be a young monk who goes to the Zen master and he asks a question, or there's one Zen master who goes to another Zen master and he asks this really challenging kind of question, and there usually ends up being either some hitting, some yelling, or they'll reach out and they'll tweak their nose or something. And one of the things that I really like about this story is that there's no testing in it. There's no, you know, there's no yelling in it. All there is a sincere, basic question that she asks the nun, and then the nun is encouraging. The nun doesn't test her, you know. She doesn't try to find out where, you know, she's just very encouraging. Oh, that's wonderful, my dear. Call this grandmotherly Zen. Grandmotherly Zen. You don't have to be a grandmother to practice grandmotherly Zen. You don't have to be a woman to practice grandmotherly Zen. You don't have to be a Buddhist to practice grandmotherly Zen. I think Tim learned, you know where I'm going with this, right? Tim learned grandmotherly Zen from his Catholic grandmother, I think. Don't you think so?
Yep.
I think it influenced the way that you teach now.
Right.
And when I read that, the nun answered her, "This is wonderful, my dear." The first thing I thought of was your grandma. Was your grandma. So, he's never tweaked my nose. He's never done that. Even under great provocation. Yet. So anyway, grandmotherly Zen. So she's wonderful. So, you know, she tells the young servant woman, you know, we make no distinctions. And she points out... she say this in here. We make no distinctions between people. She points out that she says you have aspirations too. It's not just these young women. You obviously have aspirations. You ask me these questions, and she lets the woman know. You know, you have Buddha nature. You're the Buddha also. There's not Buddha over here with the young women who have these great aspirations, and you over here. And she tells the young servant woman that there's only two things that you need in order to awaken. One is that you need to have a strong desire or aspiration for awakening. And the other is that you need to cultivate a heart of great compassion. And the heart of great compassion is, you know, the bodhisattva vow, vow to free all beings. In some places they translate that as vow to save all beings. But we say free all beings. I think another thing you could say is serve all beings. Serve all beings. And you notice that she didn't say you need to be a compassionate person right now. She said you need to cultivate a heart of great compassion. So it's just like Pema Chodron says, you need to start where you are. And you can cultivate that heart of great compassion, even if at the moment you don't feel like maybe the most compassionate person ever. So we just need to open our hearts. So Mogai Neodai becomes a nun, and one of the jobs that she continues to do through the years is carry water. And, you know, maybe she asked to keep this job as part of her work practice. Or, where's Mark? Is Mark here? Maybe Mark caught up with her and said, "Hey, Mogai Neodai, I think it'd be really cool if you kept your job carrying water." I think they had a cool work practice person who explained to them they should do these things. Well. So anyway, so she's been there for years, and she's been practicing with the nuns, and she kept her... her work practice job of carrying the water. And then she had this experience. She had this great awakening experience. And wrote the poem, which I'm going to read again. "With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bucket, and then the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail, no more moon in the water." I want to give you two different takes on this story. First of all, the moon is often used as a metaphor for enlightenment in these stories. And in this story, you could say that the bucket, the rickety bucket, is the illusory self that she's built up with all of her ideas and notions of how things are and how she is, you know. She feels intellectually inferior. She lacks these, or she feels that she lacks these impressive qualities. She has to work too hard, you know, to be able to really dedicate herself to Zen practice. You know, she has this whole sort of fictional world built up in her head. And in the beginning, you know, maybe those ideas could hold water, if you pardon the pun. But as time went by and her practice matured, she started to notice some holes and leaks in the bucket. And she started patching it with the bamboo shoots around the outside. And she's trying to hold it together, but eventually that doesn't work anymore. So the grandmotherly nun had told her, if you want to know your true nature, you need to turn toward the source of your delusive thoughts. And in Zazen practice, over time, she'd seen a lot of thoughts come and go. You know how this is. You sit for a long time, a lot of thoughts come and go. And instead of turning away from them, instead of pushing them away, if she turned toward those delusive thoughts and let them be there and then just let them go, she'd slowly begin to see them for the delusions that they are, right? You sit there long enough and these same thoughts come up and up and up. And the first thing that happens is they get very, very boring. Very boring. And years later, you're having the same boring thoughts. I'm not smart enough to do this, you know. I don't get this. I don't, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And you work through sort of the boredom of this over and over again. And at some point, you start seeing that they're just these thoughts. That's all they are. So, she said, with this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together. With this and that, that's all the ways that we try to hold it together, you know. We tell ourselves stories, we distract ourselves, we procrastinate, you know, maybe we take to one drug or another. But all of those responses and those tactics, all they do is put distance between ourselves and other people. They put distance between ourself and Buddha, or it feels like they do. So we try desperately to keep these ideas of ourselves and of our lives and of everybody else around us. We try to keep them in this box, you know, this box, this bucket that she's got. But at some point, it falls apart. So this one night, she's walking along and she's got the bucket and she's not watching where she's speaking as a mother, she's not watching where she's going, you know. She's not looking up in the sky at the actual moon. You know, there's actual enlightenment right there, shining down everywhere, lighting up the whole scene. She's not looking at that. She's not looking where she's going. She's watching the reflection of the moon in the water. And so what she's doing there is she's filtering her idea of awakening through her delusions. You know, maybe she notices when the water starts sloshing around in the bucket, maybe she notices that when that happens that the moon becomes distorted too, you know, with every step. And maybe she, at some point, makes the connection that in the same way that her view of the moon is distorted in the water, maybe it's also possible that the ideas of who she thinks she is and what her capabilities are is also distorted and held together by that rickety bucket. But I don't think it was a conscious thought. I don't think she sat and went A equals B equals C equals D and figured that out. I just think that through the long process of meditation and living her life in every moment, it all just fell away. It picked that moment to just fall away. You know, her life intersected with the life of Dogen. She was born in 1223, and he was born in 1200. So their lives, they were in the world at the same time. And when I read the poem, I thought about that line from Dogen's Fukan Zazengi, The Universal Recommendations for Zazen, where he says, "Body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your original face will manifest, will be manifest." So, you know, just, I mean, I think a lot of people have had this experience, right, where you're going along, and then just all of a sudden, everything kind of stops, and things become clear, maybe for 2 seconds, you know, maybe for a few minutes. And then the next line in the Fukan Zazengi is one of my favorites. "If you want to attain suchness, diligently practice suchness without delay." And that's what she was saying when she said, "I only have to go about my daily life practicing day and night." She's been diligently practicing suchness that entire time. So she became, she had a great awakening, and it wasn't through conscious thought to release those delusions. Just in that moment, the delusions fell away, and she had a great awakening. So that's one take on this story. And while I was thinking about it this week, I thought of another take on it. You know, you could say that this was her work practice, and as she was carrying the bucket of water and looking at the reflection of the moon in the water, she was sort of pondering her aspiration for enlightenment. You know, that the moon and the reflection of the moon in the water was her aspiration for enlightenment. And the place that she could see that in the moment was in her work. Back in, back when she talked to the nun, she said, "I only have to go about my daily life practicing day and night." So while she's doing this practice, she is starting to be able to see the moon of enlightenment within the work that she does. Just as, you know, just as we, when we do our spiritual search in our life, I think largely that happens through, it's filtered through the work that we do and the relationships that we have. I mean, that's where you're going to see. That's where you're going to have your awakening. Where else are you going to have it? You know? Where else are you going to have it? So by this time, she'd been practicing for a long time, and she's still got this kind of rickety bucket, but she's starting to get some insight into the way things are. Years ago, in the 80s, I think, I was working for a big giant corporation, and I was working on the team that supported the payroll system, the payroll and benefits system for this big company. And I was at lunch one day, and I was talking to one of the programmers, and I told her, you know, at some point in my life, I would like to have a job where I did something that benefited humankind. And I kind of said it like, you know, someday I would really like to do it. And it was an aspiration. And she said, "But you already have that job." She said, "Because of you and your efforts and what you do, twice a month, 8,000 people get paid for the work they do, and they can support their families and put a roof over their heads and take vacations and do the things they want to do because of what you do." And those were turning words for me. I mean, it might have been obvious, but it completely, completely changed the way that I looked at work. You know, and from then on, I didn't work on projects that resulted from regulatory changes to payroll and benefit systems and laws. You know, I made sure that people got the rightful pay for the work that they did, that they so they could have happy lives, useful lives, support their kids. And you know, it really did change my life. For the next 15 years, I worked for a number of really large, mostly really large organizations. I worked freelance, so I worked for, you know, 3M and Honeywell and Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank, you know, I worked for Aveda, worked for Sears Roebuck, Burlington Northern, Minnesota Zen Meditation Center. But, you know, after she said that to me that day, you know, you have your ups and downs, but after that, my attitude and my point of view was never on whatever systems we were working on or whatever the project was we were working on. The question was always, you know, what we're doing here is trying to make things better for people in some way. Let's keep our eye on that, you know? So it was just a whole different way of thinking about working. And that nameless programmer is one of my Zen heroes to this day. So here's Mugen Yodai, and she's been carrying water back and forth for all these years. And instead of this one evening, instead of thinking, well, here I am again, schlepping water from the stream back up to the convent like I've done 100 times before, she realized that what she was actually doing was helping provide her Dharma sisters with what they needed to sustain life. So she had that thought. And instead of seeing... And the moon, the bottom of her bucket fell out, and instead of seeing the moon of enlightenment just reflected in this one place, you know, in the moon, in the bucket, instead of just seeing it reflected there, the bottom falls out, and suddenly the water goes everywhere. You know, it's flying everywhere, and in each one of those tiny little drops of water that's flying everywhere, she sees the moon of enlightenment reflected in every single one of them. She understands that she's surrounded by enlightenment, that it's shining everywhere. And even as she's seeing enlightenment, you know, flying all over the place, the moon is still up there. The moon is still there, you know, it's still shining on everybody. It's still right up there being a moon. It's lighting the path for her and everyone else. It's there whether she sees it or not. It's there when it's a big full moon. It's there when it's a little sliver. It's there when it's covered by clouds. You know, it's always there whether we can see it or not. So that's my other take on this poem. I think it's the Walt Whitman of Enlightenment poems. It contains multitudes. I think that's what I want to say about the Enlightenment poem. Oh, the place, I want to say one other thing. The place that I first read this story, I've seen it a number of places since then, but the first place I saw it was in this book. I've never brought in a book on an e-reader before, but I got this book. It's called The Hidden Lamp. Can you see that? It's called The Hidden Lamp. Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. So it's a book that has stories and koans from Buddhist women all the way back to the Buddha's time up through... modern women today. And I think that it's true, we're going to use it for a study group, right, in the fall. And also, the woman who edited the book, Florence Kaplow, is going to be here in town, and she is going to be here on Friday, April 4th, in the evening to give a talk or something. So anyway, so I recommend the book. It's full of stories and koans about women, and then contemporary women's take on each story. So, does anybody else have a take on it they want to tell, or a question, or yeah?
As you were telling the story, I thought maybe another take on it is letting go of delusions about enlightenment.
Absolutely.
That if you think and speak too much about enlightenment, you run the risk of turning it into a thing to be grasped or to be carried in a bucket.
Yeah.
And it was only when that reflection, that illusion went away that she got it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, it's true. You have this idea about what it is, and you have this idea about it being impossible. You know? Or if you skew towards the grandiosity end, you have this idea that, why, I'm already enlightened, and these people should be listening to me. You know, this is going out on the internet. Boy, all those lucky people are going to hear my enlightened words if you skew towards the grandiosity, which I don't recommend. Because what happens is... Anybody else? Yeah.
I was thinking about how there was nothing there anymore, and it was kind of an emptying into the nothingness and the surrender into that.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt good.
Yeah, we think about surrendering into nothingness or emptiness. Sometimes people think of that as something very scary. But that's just because we use those scary words like surrender and emptiness and nothingness. You know, why not say vastness? You know, I'm going to relax into vastness. Yeah.
And a nose tweak, break the bucket bottom.
He double dog dared me. Come here, come here, come here. Yeah, somebody else back there had a question. Yeah, Lena. Yeah, she'd been working on her whole life, and then the bucket just fell apart. Yeah, just like that. Want to say a little more about that?
Sometimes, but it's kind of just kind of hold it together.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of us know what that feels like, trying to hold this bucket together, and oh man, using bamboo strips, and you're using magical incantations, you know, you're using whatever you can come up with, and then at some point, the bucket's going to fall apart. Yeah.
Rick, also reminded me, as you were talking, and just another comment about illusion and religion.
Uh-huh.
So then the next question that popped in my mind, well, what is truth?
Yeah.
Do we need to know what that is at all?
Yeah.
It just all falls apart and let it go.
Yeah.
So hang on to it. You need to know what that truth is.
Well, who's giving the talk next week? Maybe they could discuss that. Maybe they could... is it you, Ted?
No.
I know.
Guy.
Oh, Guy. He's covering his eyes. Everybody be here.
I want to ask a couple things. What struck me today was how when you first started telling the story of a Buddhist, how much I craved hearing the story of a Buddhist, and I have a little picture
because I bought a one-way ticket to Bangkok, Thailand, when I was 25. And I have one picture. I stare at a lot of these little girl pink Sudanese and older women nuns, and I always want to know more about them, but I haven't been back to Bangkok, Thailand since. And so what strikes me is just I kept falling asleep and waking up, because whenever things are really important, I start falling asleep.
Mm.
And so simultaneously I fell asleep and woke up quite a few times because I'm tired from shoveling a lot of snow.
Yeah.
But also just the simplicity and complexity of the story just is so beautiful to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the movie Saving Mr. Banks last night, which is about the making.
Oh, yeah.
Walt Disney talking this very complex woman who wrote the story of Mary Poppins for 20 years into letting him make the movie. But it's about tweaking and gentle grandmotherliness in men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great story.
Yeah.
It's similar. So I also was falling asleep and very engaged.
After I saw that, the Saving Mr. Banks, I went and checked Mary Poppins out of the library. And everybody should read Mary Poppins, and it's totally different. It's very, very different from the movie. Mugai Neodai, let me give you just a little bit about her historical life. We don't know very much about it, but she was actually born into the samurai class. And she was highly educated in both Japanese and Chinese. And she married a samurai. They had a daughter. And she started going for instruction to the local Rinzai Zen monastery. There was a Chinese Rinzai monk there. And it was very unusual for them to teach lay women at that time, but they also had this rule that you couldn't turn anybody away if they came for instruction. So she went there and studied with him for many years. I think he died when she was about 60. But after her husband died and her daughter grew up and got married and moved away, she decided to become a nun, and he gave her the name Mugai Neodai. And before he died, he named her his successor, which didn't go over so well with the monks. And she eventually started a opened a group of convents, five convents or something, and she became the first woman to successfully propagate Rinzai Zen in Japan. So it's about as close to the movie version I just told you as the movie Mary Poppins is to the book Mary Poppins. But they're both, you know, way to go, Miyoga, you know. So yeah, according to the teaching story, she was illiterate. But the historical woman was highly educated, and let's see, she eventually founded and served as abbess of the Five Mountain Rinzai Zen Convent Association. And I found an article from the New York Times from 1998, where a group of cloistered nuns from Japan came to New York City, and they went to St. Paul's Chapel at Columbia and did a ceremony honoring Mugai Neodai. And it was the first time most of them had been out of Japan, and it was the first time the ceremony had been done anywhere outside of Japan. And it made the New York Times, and it was supposedly just this really beautiful ceremony. So she's quite something.
customer attempts to, with this and that, to keep the bucket together. It could be like the, and then you have the sudden enlightenment of the bottom falling out, but it's mm-hmm. like the this and the that are like her, are the gradual enlightenment. So it's the practice, and there's some kind of delusion in the misconception of what enlightenment is or does, but the practice itself sort of actually gets her to the point where the bottom can fall out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's just a very rich poem. It's and story, I think. And whenever they talk about, whenever I hear sudden enlightenment, I always think overnight success, you know. And there may be overnight successes, but I think usually they have years and years and years of some kind of practice behind them. Whether it's a venerated Rinzai nun or a musician of some sort. Mm-hmm.